The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Sarah Robb O'Hagan. Sarah is an executive, activist, and entrepreneur, and the founder of Extreme U, a movement to unleash high performance. She was the global president of Gatorade, the former president of Equinox Fitness Clubs, and has held leadership positions at Nike and Virgin Atlantic Airways. She is currently the CEO of the fitness company Flywheel Sports and is the author of a terrific new book, Extreme U, Step Up, Stand Out, Kick Ass, Repeat. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I want to start our conversation with a story you tell in your book. And this is a time at Nike where you're handed a new team. And you've got people there who are junior, people there who are incredibly senior. And it struck me in this like initial meeting that you actually embraced the rules of improvisation. You use a lot of structure and detail while allowing your team to create a bunch of different ideas that turned into a real cool event. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd never thought about it as the structure of improvisation. I'm going to remember that now. That sounds so cool. we were basically tasked. I'd only been at the company for 2 weeks, I think, and we were tasked with, you must come up with a giant idea to get 10,000 people to participate in something to market this great shoe Nike was launching. Mm. And I'm like, well, holy shit, where does one even start? I'm new. And I realize when you bring a group together, particularly from completely different disciplines, if you just sort of sit in a room and say, okay, guys, let's brainstorm, you're going to go nowhere fast because it's just got no structure. Whereas if you kind of guide it through, like, what are some specific questions that we're actually trying to answer, that is what, in a funny way, leads the sparks to suck off of each other and become something quite magnificent that you would never have even seen was there.
And you guys found this thing, because it's in Los Angeles where people love music, and you focused in on the 80s.
Yeah, it was awesome. So it was basically, the idea was we were going to put on a 10-day running race. We've all done tons of those. And we're like, well, how are we going to do something that's original and different? And LA is like the culture of music. And so we're like, well, it should be running with music, but, well, there's already a rock and roll marathon, so how do we be different? And it was more the play on words of, oh, remember the 80s, one-hit wonder bands? Wait, one-hit wonder, that's it. Mm-hmm. And the best part about the whole story is, like, our poor entertainment marketing team, when they had to, we thought it was such a great idea, how fun could this be? They had to pitch these bands. So imagine ringing up the lead singer from Flock of Seagulls and saying, you have to sing And I Ran over and over and over again for 60 minutes because everyone running by needs to get the perfect soundtrack. So no new material.
Uh-huh. By the way, does he have any hair left? Because I don't think he does.
I know. We were so looking for the fountain of hair, and it wasn't there anymore.
No, it is not there. I love it. And this is the cool thing about this book, because you mix your own stories with examples of other people's stories, and then this philosophy that you've developed over the years. And I want to talk a little bit about the philosophy, because it does tie into improvisational work as well. And you talk about this idea of trying it on. And I love the advice you got from your field hockey coach, who told you, quote, if you expect someone to pass you the ball, you better get into position to receive it. That's great advice.
Yes, it is great advice. No, it's all about, I have this chapter called Check Yourself Out. And one of the things, I had this huge epiphany as I was researching and interviewing people for the book, that many of us are taught when we sort of come through college to have a goal and work towards it, like have a career ambition, whatever that may be. But actually, if you focus more on developing yourself and your unique skills, passions, specialties, whatever it is, like, and really playing into them. When the ball comes your way, you will be in position to receive it because you will have found yourself like fully developed in the areas that are uniquely interesting to you. And then when the opportunity opens up that's in that area, you're the one who's ready to go. I use an example in the book, Sam Kass, who's the former White House chef. Like, never when he left college did he know there was such a job as White House chef, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he starts developing his passion for the politics of food and cooking and combines that with the fact that he was an ex very, very high-level baseball player. So teamwork and competitive spirit. And when he finds himself, like, bumping into a meeting with, you know, Senator Barack Obama, who's looking for a chef, like, he is in position to receive that ball. He was the person who was more qualified than anyone because he'd just gone on this journey of developing himself. And it was a real epiphany for me of, like, stop trying to find the goal and go after it and just instead develop yourself.
Yeah, and the Sam story is great, too. I mean, obviously, there's a Chicago angle there, but it also reminds me of just the concept around deliberate practice, because what you're doing is you're trying a lot of stuff, but then also he had mentorship. And I think that is crucial in this book across the board, that at some point, everyone in the book who is looking to be successful only gets that success when there's that sort of mentorship relationship up and down.
Totally. And that came through so many times. Like, it was interesting to me, even when I got into many of the topics of failure, how often people get into trouble when they're trying to look like they've got all the answers instead of just having the vulnerability to ask for help
mm-hmm.
and mentorship. And it was actually, you know, some of the people I interviewed in the book, as you know, are some of the most extraordinarily successful humans in the world. And what they had in common is, like, I'm going to seek people that can help me. I'm not scared of my imperfections. I see them as opportunities to grow.
I got to say, though, and this ties right into that, my favorite part of this book is how often you get fired. Or, I mean, this is a rare business book that is like, and then I got fired.
And again.
But this is to this core point around failure, which is anyone who is attempting to be truly innovative is failing a ton. We know this through our work. You experience this firsthand. And in fact, you know, I mean, what we always say in improv is that failure isn't the problem. It's fear of failure that is the problem.
Yes. Oh, I love that. I love that. That's so great. Because what's interesting to me, having been to your studio in Chicago and watched your shows, like, you almost, the perfection with which they do improv blows me away. But I have often thought to myself, I bet you there's hours that go behind it where it doesn't, you know, connect.
Doesn't work at all. No. Doesn't. And we do that in front of the often. I mean, this is the other thing about when you come into our spaces, the audience actually enjoys it sometimes when it doesn't go right. They get to see it
right
in front of them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's funny because your point about the fear of failure, I mean, that was actually one of the single biggest reasons I wrote this book, is, like, I saw it in the young employees that were working for me. I saw it statistically in that, you know, every generation since the boomers have become statistically much more scared of failure and therefore more risk averse. And it's like, whoa, this has to stop. Like, the reason we're getting like that is because we sort of have this crazy culture of success and perfection. Like, everywhere you turn, there's people, you know, touting on social media how amazing they are and kind of leaving out the bits of the really embarrassing screw-ups along the way. And that's why I was like, okay, high time someone actually was honest about it. And let's be honest, I'm a train wreck. I've been fired a couple times. Let's go there.
And that speaks to, you know, every brand in the world wants authenticity. And I think most people want that as part of their personal brand. But you don't get authenticity without the blemishes, which are usually significant. And I'm going to quote you from the book. You say, personal branding is less about attracting legions of followers on Facebook and more about knowing who you are and what you stand for.
100%, yeah. I, as a parent, am really distressed by the fact that now, as young as, you know, teenagers, kids are judging themselves on how many likes they get on a picture on Instagram. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, at the end of the day, you just need to know who you are, be very true to who you are, and be comfortable with what people like and don't like about you. And that in itself is authenticity. And that in itself is what attracts people to you, whether it's as friendships, whether it's as, you know, followers from a leadership standpoint. And I think we've gotten this whole thing ass backwards, to use a Kiwi saying, in terms of people judging people's success on the number of followers instead of, like, actually stop. Like, does this person authentically lead and know who they are and have the kind of credibility and basically resilience to lead through tough times because they know who they are?
Yeah. You know, having worked at Second City for really my entire adult life, about 30 years, I'm privy to all this great sort of oral tradition that's handed down. And one of the great stories from the early days was the time that Sir Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa came to Second City and then did the improv set with the cast.
Are you serious right now?
Yeah, I'm totally serious. But you wouldn't know that because, of course, there was no video of it. And in your book, you actually say Sir Edmund Hillary's epic climb to the top of the mountain is even more relevant today because there are no photos of him at the summit. He didn't need a selfie.
Exactly. I can't believe he did improv.
Yeah, and a Sherpa.
Tenzing,
yeah.
Was it?
That's yeah,
amazing.
You got it. Yeah, it was pretty
That's
cool.
Amazing. And did, like, how did people respond?
They went nuts. I mean, this is, you know, what, the early 60s, and it's a worldwide event, and they're in this, and it was winter in Chicago. By the way, I'm sorry. I know you lived here for a while.
I love Chicago. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but those winters, they suck.
I will agree, yes.
I would think, especially for you, right? You're not used to that.
Totally. Yeah, I was so unprepared for my first Chicago winter, for sure.
And I think when you were talking, too, about kids, and we should talk about it a little, because I have a 19-year-old and a 15-year-old, and you talk about something I completely believe in, which is we've got this terrible thing that's happened of not letting kids experience losing.
Yeah. So, yes, I am a, like, very vehement opposer of the famous participation trophy. I can't stand them.
Yep.
Because my, you know, kids have come home with them from their junior soccer tournaments, whatever, and you're like, what the hell? Like, you don't get a trophy for showing up. And even, quite frankly, I just went to my kids' fifth grade graduation recently, and it was like a diploma for getting through fifth grade. Like, last time I checked, that's a legal requirement of being a human in this country.
Yeah.
And it's just, we've so kind of taught kids to, like, it came from the self-esteem movement of, like, I guess somewhere 20, 30 years ago, psychologists thought that if we kind of overpraised kids that it was better for their self-esteem. But, you know, protecting them from failure and protecting them from making mistakes and losing, all those things, those are such important ingredients to understanding who you are, understanding where you dig deep to get your own sort of resource of resilience from. And to take that away from a kid is just awful, in my view.
Yeah, well, it's cruel. I mean, literally, you're not training them for what the rest of their life is going to be, which is, you know, getting over shame and having to play with vulnerability. I always talk about improvisation allowing you to sort of mindfully linger inside a mistake. That's often what happens.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I love that.
But that's, you don't get that. And what so much of this book about is, like, I fucked up at this. I screwed up at that. I'm not good at this. I'm not good at that. And guess what? I've done okay. And that is the lesson to learn. And kids need to learn that by screwing up and then living to tell
Absolutely.
The day.
Yeah, and particularly kids, because, you know, that vulnerable time that all, I'm sure your kids have just been through it, of peer pressure and teen years and all that stuff, like, that's the time more than any when just help them know it's okay. Like, the road is long in front of you, and every mistake is an opportunity to grow and learn. That's awesome.
I want to talk about your gig at Virgin, and in particular, because you met someone there, they got excited for you to join, but you had to wait for a visa.
Yeah, so I had, like, dreamed of working at Virgin Atlantic for a long, long time, and being at the time a foreigner, I'm now an American citizen, but, you know, you have to wait to get your visa approved, and this is back in the Clinton administration when the government shut down. By the way, that's been happening for many administrations, but where they don't process, you know, anything. And so here I've secured the job, and literally 3 months goes by, and I can't start working there because I don't have a visa, and I'm terrified that they're going to give up on me, you know, and said, listen, we need someone else to do the job. But in the end, it all came through. But it was a real lesson, not only in patience, but at the time I was like, okay, I'm dying here because I just feel like I'm treading water. How do I use this time to set other goals in my life? And in that case, you know, fitness goals, to really get through it and to kind of hone my drive in a different way.
And then you got to Virgin, right? And you didn't necessarily have the job that you thought you were going to have, which I thought was interesting. And I'm gonna ask you to talk about this, because you also have a quote where you say, try to contribute big on day one. And you did a fairly audacious move close to day one, right?
Yeah, so I had moved from L.A. to New York, maxed out every goddamn credit card that I can ever have access mm-hmm. to. I'm living in a shitty, tiny apartment with no air conditioning, and I managed to, like, I literally went for 3 days without eating just to have enough money for the train ticket to get to work on the first day because I wasn't mm-hmm. being paid till the next, right? So I show up all ready for my job, and I get to the front desk, and they say, who are you? You know, I say my name, and I say I'm here to meet with this woman who was my boss, and they say, oh, she doesn't work here anymore. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Oh, no.
And so, long story short, this woman had left the company a week prior. Nobody really knows me, so I'm sort of, like, stuck into this, like, cube in the back of the marketing department. Like, they'll deal with me later. And that's when I realized, like, I'm either going to get pushed out, like, you know, the last piece of inventory in a warehouse because I'm new and I've got no credibility and the person who hired me just left, or I'm going to double down and deliver value as fast as I can. And so I basically ended up writing a whole marketing plan and an organizational chart and a whole strategy and putting it in an envelope under the president's door to say, I know you don't know me, but I can see big opportunities for this team and this business, and I can contribute, and here are my ideas. And it's a great, like, I still to this day cannot believe he didn't just say I was way over my skis for doing it, but instead he actually promoted me. You know, I ended up getting a bigger job and being able to execute a lot of those plans. And the reason I think it's an important story, particularly for young people today, is the number of people that walk into my office and say, you know, okay, I'm ready to be promoted. And I'm like, what are you doing to show that you're operating at that next level? Get out and just do it, you know, mm-hmm. because there's this expectation that it's on the boss to kind of recognize or, you know, or make the move for the employee. And no, it's like, if you want to progress, you better get out there and create your own future. Make it happen. Like, deliver value over and above what you're expected to, and you'll be amazed the kind of responses that will come to you if you do that.
Again, one of the things I love about your telling of this story in the book is that you don't just sort of say, so everyone go be big on day one. You got to do that. That's your way to success, because you actually talk about the fact that that can really fuck you over on the other side, especially if I like this phrase where when you're all balls and no respect.
Yeah, for sure. No, because I talked about, like, there is a time and a place to what I call get out of line, which is mm-hmm. the example I just gave. And that is when you have enough credibility. So in my case, I'd actually been working in the airline industry for a number of years. I had a lot of depth in terms of my knowledge. You have enough credibility. You see a gap in front of you that you can fill, and you basically go a way that is delivering value not only to your boss but your teammates. It's when you become that person who is basically a jackass, who's full of themselves, who's like, I got all the ideas and I'm trying to get noticed and I'm trying to brown nose and I'm trying to just get, that turns the whole team off and it mm-hmm. totally backfires, and then you've got no support behind you.
Yeah. I mean, this is so crucial in our work because, you know, human beings are just not wired to work well with others because we're all so, you know, incredibly self-centered. We're all worried about ourselves. And when you can, and this is the thing that happens in improv, is you are forced to be others focused. You have to listen to every word the person across you is saying. It is your job to make them look better. And then lo and behold, what happens, you create something bigger than one person ever could, because you're truly doing it together. And that is all about mutual respect.
What an awesome, awesome skill, though, right?
Yeah.
To know, like that's what I love about improv in general. Is that you simply cannot succeed on your own, and
no.
That's a really neat, like lesson, because I think you're 100% right. We don't, in general, we think that if we shine above the others, that's going to work. And it, eventually, it might work in a short amount of time. Eventually, it catches up with you for sure.
Yep. Hey, tell us about your time in Chicago working for Gatorade, because you really came in at a time when incredible change was happening with that yeah. brand.
Yeah, I joined in 2008, which was just before the Great Recession, of course.
Oh, that
great
was fun.
Great career timing. Yeah. And at the time I came in, you know, the brief was kind of like, it's a little dated, the business is stalled, you know, we just need you to sort of jazz it up a bit and make it get on fire from a marketing standpoint, and away we go. Well, that was far from the case, because obviously the recession happened, and then very quickly the business went into huge decline. I mean, losing hundreds of millions of dollars a year off its top line, and it was a very stressful time for the whole company, actually. But what it was very evident to me was that you know, small incremental moves were not going to solve the problem. We had to take really, really bold and courageous steps. And obviously, I had an amazing team of people I was working with, and we ended up moving Gatorade to what is now known as G and the G series, like with all the products of before, during, and after exercise. And not only did we turn the core business around, but obviously they've gone on to have a great growth runway. And honestly, I think it came from incredible courage and incredible sort of tenacity of a team to just say, we know what consumer wants, and we're going to stick with it, and we're not going to get distracted by the small failures along the way, of which there were many.
Yeah, and this is the thing about that time, and this has been explored on the podcast before, that almost any great creative act doesn't come out of everything working well. That's mostly where it doesn't happen. It's usually when there's just some incredible, uncomfortable problem. And I remember Michael Slaby, who was the CTO for Obama for the first campaign, was like, the only reason we were innovative is because we were losing.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Isn't that great?
Yeah. They had to find a new way to beat, that particular problem. Before I get to, and God, this goes so fast, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I want to know what's up at your current gig, because it struck, am I right? Like you weren't working for Flywheel Sports when you started writing this book. It felt like that happened in later chapter.
Yes. Yeah. And that is actually my yes and story.
Oh, well, we can go into it. That's fine.
Because, no, it's funny. I literally had like steadfastly said to anyone around me, no, I am not taking another job until after my book launches, which was April of this year, because I really wanted, I'd worked so hard on it, and I wanted to make sure I really gave enough of my time and energy to getting it off the ground, the sort of platform I was building around it. No, 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 no. So then along comes Lou Frankfurt, who's the lead investor in Flywheel and is a legend of the retail world, and he just comes and keeps niggling at me, saying, I really think this is an opportunity you should consider. I keep saying no, no, no. And eventually it really did become yes, and oh my God, this is the best opportunity that's ever been put in front of me. And like the perfect culmination of 25 years of a career in things like airlines and sports and all the things I've been doing, that sort of came together in one place. And I was like, yes, and I'm going to friggin' crush this. Like, this was designed for me.
Oh, that's amazing. And I'm curious, too, with your kids are getting older now, how has being a mom in that situation affected your attitude towards your work?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think for me, my kids keep me incredibly grounded, you know, on the most stressful days. And particularly, it's funny, when I was going through the Gatorade turnaround and living through my first horrendous Chicago winter and my third baby had just been born, like, oh my God. But as stressful as it was, you come home and there's that little face, you know, it just makes you realize that's really what it's all about. And I think even on the worst days, at least I kind of had that to keep me centered. And I think even now, like, my kids are older, and you definitely see what I love about kids, especially about your world, is their just innate ability to throw themselves into things, not really care if they look like idiots, like, use their imagination in a way that adults have sort of lost touch with. And I always look at them and think, we've got to hold on to that as grown-ups, you know?
Yeah, because we don't. We lose it. It gets educated or trained out of us to be constantly drawing outside the lines.
Yeah, 100%.
And the great thing about, again, this is a good book. Everyone should get it. It's called Extreme You. Sara Rabo Hagen, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's been a blast. Thank you. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my work day is over, too tired for having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine.